series on rediscovering the ancient ways of Christianity. Last week was the first part, and we spoke about the need for community, loneliness, life transitions, and feasting. And in part one, which is now online, we spoke, of course, about the problems of loneliness, about atomization and fragmentation in society, and the reasons that our little friend here, the atheist Alain de Botton, said that society was this way. He pointed to huge numbers of people, right? Society big. He talked about bad spaces, rather humorously, spaces that are poorly suited for gathering people together. He spoke about people not needing each other as much, which is definitely true, I think. We have insurance now rather than calling our neighbors up when our house washes away, as we saw a lot this past week. We have total media saturation. We could be connected to something pretty much all the time if we chose to. In fact, now it's a decision to take ourselves off the grid, isn't it? And we have to really work hard to get time away from that. And another reason would be kind of the main societal value of success at any cost. And even if it's not success in the form of, I'm going to make $1 million, it's success in terms of perfectionism, right? Being perfectionistic with ourselves, driving ourselves toward this, whatever this perfect goal would be we have in our mind. So we have sometimes an internalized perfectionism, but also at times this drive for success in the workplace too. So Christianity's strength, Alain de Botton notes, lies precisely in challenging all of these things very strongly, very seriously. It encourages us to reflect upon our fears, and then it challenges us. So our fear of powerlessness, he mentioned, is challenged by the power of Christ, right? Who shows the victory through powerlessness. So powerlessness conquered by his own powerlessness, which is full of power. Or poverty is conquered by the wealth of one who become poor for us in the form of Christ, right? Or meaninglessness is conquered by a life that would appear to others meaningless that really is pregnant with meaning and is the very crux of the entire universe as we understand it. So all these things, all these fears we have are challenged and addressed specifically and clearly, at least in our case, by the figure of our Lord. So he also spoke a bit about the key to authentic religion, we would say the key to Christianity, lies in a sacramental worldview, bringing people together in a community, in communion, and having mechanisms to do that, right? So there's mechanisms of reconciliation and forgiveness, Forgiveness Sunday, the various things we do to reconcile with each other, that's part of our life in Christ, tools for managing life transitions, birth, death, marriage, coming of age, all these different parts of our life, prayers when we're sick, prayers when we're in need of something particular. And all of this forms the kind of mortar, if you will, of faith, which, while he doesn't believe in the dogmas that are being propounded, he says, this is really interesting. This is really meaningful. This is something we should stop and look at. So, and of course, for us, it's more than stopping and looking at it. But we're grateful when someone outside our faith stops and examines it, right? Because that's a good moment for us. So this week we're going to talk about the way, fostering ways of goodness, virtues, vices, role models, a.k.a. saints. And in the first paragraph of this chapter, de Botton identifies a major problem. He says this: once we are grown up, we are seldom encouraged officially to be nice to each other. A key assumption of modern Western political thinking is that we should be left alone to live as we like without being nagged, without fear of moral judgment, without being subject to the whims of authority. Freedom has become our supreme political virtue. It is not thought to be the state's task to promote a vision of how we should act towards each other, or to send us to hear lectures about chivalry or politeness. Modern politics on both the left and the right is dominated by what we could call a libertarian ideology. In his On Liberty of 1859, John Stuart Mill, one of the earliest and most articulate advocates of this hands-off approach, explained, quote, "The only purpose for which power can be rightfully exercised over any member of the civilized community against his will is to prevent harm to others. His own good, either physical or moral, is not sufficient warrant." This is a great statement of probably the dominant philosophy politically of our time, I think. "In this scheme," Alain de Botton continues, "the state should harbor no aspirations to tinker with the inner well-being or outward manner of its members. The foibles of citizens are placed beyond comment or criticism for fear of turning government into that most reviled, unpalatable kind of authority in libertarian eyes, that is, the nanny state." And, you know, this approach is entirely what we deal with on both. This is not like, oh, a Republican or a liberal. This is a culture-wide approach that's been adopted really by everybody. But it contrasts very powerfully with St. John Chrysostom's approach to civil society, which I just shared with you because I think it's so interesting. He has a wonderful homily on wealth and poverty. I'm going to share a paragraph here. This is not in this book. "The possessions of the emperor, the city squares, the streets, they belong to everybody," St. John says, "and we all use them in an equal degree. Look at the economy of God that he has arranged. He's created some things that are for everyone, including the air, the sun, water, earth, heaven, sea, light, and stars. He's divided them equally among all people, as if we were brothers. This, if nothing else, should shame the human race. The emperor has made other things common to all, including the cities, the baths, the streets. There's not the slightest disagreement over this common property, but everything is accomplished peacefully. If someone tries to take something and claim it as his own personal possession, quarrels arise. It is as if the very forces of nature were complaining, as if that at that time when God was gathering them from everywhere, they were trying with all their might to separate among themselves, to isolate themselves from each other, and to distinguish their own individual property by coldly saying that this is yours, but that is mine. If this were true, quarrels and bitterness would arise, but where there is nothing of this sort, neither quarrels nor disagreements occur. In this way, we see that for us as well, a common and not individual ownership of things has been ordained, and that this is according to nature itself. It is not the reason that no one ever goes to court about the ownership of a public square, the fact that the square belongs to us all." So he's articulating a very different view, an idea that we share a lot in society about, in some form or fashion, coming together, having common space, having points where we come together. And I would say that the very point of our faith is explicitly to unite us all together in Christ, right? In Christ together, worshiping the Lord in the brotherhood and the sonship that is of God. And to do this, we would say, you can't simply preach morality to people. We have to allow goodness to be fostered in our hearts and our lives. And this is what God calls us to do. And this is what Botton is realizing, is that the state can't do this. States aren't good at that. It's something else. And he looks at religion and he's jealous because we have something that the state can never do. And for someone like him, the ultimate reference point is going to be the state. Because what else do you have if you're a secular atheist? So he writes this: "A great many other decrees extend their reach dramatically far beyond what a libertarian political ideology would judge to be appropriate bounds. The religious code, though, is obsessed with the details of how we should behave with our families, our colleagues, strangers, and even animals. It dictates that we must never sit down to eat a meal before we've fed our goats or camels." He's talking about the law here, of course. "That we should ask our parents for permission when agreeing to go on a journey of more than one night's duration. That we should invite widows in our communities to dinner every springtime. That we should beat our olive trees only once during the harvest so as to leave remaining fruit to the fatherless and the poor. Such recommendations are capped by injunctions on how often to have sex in Judaism, with men told their duty before God to make love to their wives regularly, according to a timetable that aligns frequency with the scale of their professional commitments. Quote from the Mishnah: for men of independent means every day, for laborers twice a week, for donkey drivers once a week, for camel drivers once in 30 days, For sale is once in 6 months, etc. So this is sort of, he's having fun here. He continues, in secular society, by the libertarian's reckoning, a firm line should divide conduct that is subject to law from conduct that is subject to personal morality. It should fall to parliaments, to police forces, courts, and prisons to prevent harm to citizens' life or property. But more ambiguous varieties of mischief should remain within the province of conscience. Thus, the stealing of the ox is in a matter to be investigated by the police, whereas the oppression of someone's spirit through two decades of indifference is not. This reluctance to get involved in private matters is rooted less in indifference than in skepticism, and more specifically, in a pervasive doubt that anyone could ever be in a position to know exactly what virtue is, let alone how it might be safely and judiciously instilled in others. Aware of the inherent complexity of ethical choices, libertarians cannot fail to notice how few issues fall cleanly into unassailable categories of right and wrong. What may seem like obvious truths to one party can be seen by another as culturally biased prejudices. Looking back upon centuries of religious self-assurance, libertarians stand transfixed by the dangers of conviction. An abhorrence of crude moralism has banished talk of morality from the public square. The impulse to question the behavior of others trembles before the likely answer, who are you to tell me what to do? And this is a big sort of serious question, you know, and this is why I think it's hard for even religious people to want to speak too loudly in the public square, because we're aware in the West, who am I to speak so boldly in the public square, right? When part of the very basis for my being accepted as an equal member of society, since we're a minority, we're a religious minority here, aren't we? The very basis for our being safe as a religious minority is that we recognize that we all kind of agree no one has the right to impose his morality on anyone else. That's kind of the basis, if you will, of how this society operates. But what he's doing is pointing out, he's not trying to resolve the problem politically. He's trying to point out the problem in our individual lives, at the very least. And he comes to the image of parenting to help kind of give us a visual image of the challenge here. So when we think about parenting, it is not about crude moralism, really. It's about, you know, it's not about me saying to my son, you know, do this, don't do that, you know, just for the sake of the rules. Really, it's about shaping a person, right? Giving shape to this person's life, helping him to navigate what it means to be a human being. And of course, my faith is really part of that. Common sense is part of that too. The way I was formed, rightly or wrongly, is part of that, as it is for almost all of us. Right? Our parents are either the greatest examples or they're the greatest negative examples, one way or the other. That's what we're doing when we parent. But parenting is an essential task, otherwise everything breaks down. So he writes this: to be a parent is inevitably to mediate forcefully in the lives of one's offspring in the hope that they will someday grow up to be not only law-abiding, but also nice. That is, thoughtful with their partners, generous toward the fatherless, self-conscious about their motives, uninclined to wallow in sloth or self-pity. In their length and intensity, parents' admonishments rival those laid out in the Jewish Mishnah. Faced with the same two questions which so trouble libertarian theorists in the political sphere, who are you to tell me what to do, and how do you know what is right? Parents have little difficulty in arriving at answers. Even as they frustrate their children's immediate wishes, often to the sound of ear-splitting screams, they tend to feel sure that they are guiding them to act in accordance with the norms which they would willingly respect if only they were capable of fully developing reason and self-control. To lend concrete form to their pronouncements, parents are often moved to draw up star charts. Complex domestic political settlements usually be found fastened on the sides of fridges or the doors of pantries, which set forth in exhaustive detail the specific behaviors they expect from and will reward in their children. Noting the considerable behavioral improvements these star charts tend to produce, along with the satisfaction that children appear to derive from having them, libertarian adults may be tempted to suggest, with a modest laugh at such an absurd idea, that they themselves would benefit from having a star chart pinned to the wall
to keep track of their own eccentricities.
I like that. So what would a star chart, you know, he sort of thinks about this from a very simple point of view. What would a star chart for us look like? Well, he says, forgiving others, being slow to anger, daring to imagine how someone else might feel, putting yourself in their shoes, setting up your own struggles, setting your own struggles aside, and having the drama of your life put in perspective. Being open to very simple and maybe cliched advice. These are things that we might put little stars on in people's lives, right? These are very simple things. By the way, probably the most cliched advice, venue for dispensing and receiving advice is confession. Let's admit it. The advice we hear, confession is not chiefly about giving and dispensing advice. It's about forgiveness of sins for us. But let's be honest, what we tend to hear in confession and receive is very simple stuff. Were you kind to your mother? What did you say to her? When you talked to your son, did you have anger in your voice? Did you shame him? Are you sorry for what you did to him? This is not rocket science here. It's not brain surgery. This is very simple, almost cliched stuff. But that doesn't make it any less helpful or less true, does it? Or less powerful. When I go to my confessor, because of the way, and this is the beauty of it, when I go to confession, because I'm preparing to go, I just got to go yesterday, in fact. When I go, I get to kind of prepare myself, look at my sins, and I go and I open my heart to what he has to say. And he doesn't say tons. And it's very simple stuff that maybe anyone can say. But when he says it, because of the grace of God, because of the moment, I hear it and it resonates. And it usually is very helpful, even in very simple ways. So anyway, it's kind of the moment where we pull out the star charts and, you know, we say, here's what's going wrong. And sometimes in confession, I'd even say, yeah, he'll ask, you know, how's the prayer rule going? And I might say, well, this thing's really, I'm really struggling with this thing, but with this thing, Father, I'm doing better. You know, and you're not supposed to make confession about how good you are. But occasionally things will happen. Like, you know, I'm doing better with this thing. And to know that you have to face your confessor, there's an aspect of, you don't want to go and be ashamed. You want to go and, like with your parents, you want them to be proud of you. It's sort of strange, but there's an aspect of that there. Though that's not what it's about, but there's something there that's similar. So, anyway, one of the temptations of our life, I think, that he mentions, is to see my problems as unique and unconquerable. But this, he argues, and I agree with him, is simply not true. The problems that you and I face in general are not particularly special. They can be ameliorated, oftentimes, or at least dealt with through very simple means. And so he speaks a bit about some of these things. A lack of freedom is no longer, in most developed societies, the problem we face. Our downfall lies in our inability to make the most of the freedom that our ancestors painfully secured for us over the past centuries. We've grown sick from being left to do as we please without sufficient wisdom to exploit our liberty. It is not primarily the case that we find ourselves at the mercy of authorities whose claims we resent or want to be free of. The danger for us now runs in the opposite direction. Yes. We face temptations which we revile in those interludes when we can attain a sufficient distance from them, which we lack the encouragement to resist, much to our eventual self-disgust and disappointment. Isn't that so true, though? Think about it. What are the things that plague us? It's these little passions, we would say in Orthodox, these little things that we can't control in our lives, right? And so part of what drew many of us, I think, to Orthodoxy, logically, was a desire for some structure and stability and a way that I could begin with other Christians to work through some of these things that I struggle with. Whatever, you know, and we all have different things we struggle with, and there's commonality, too. The mature sides of us watch in despair as the infantile aspects of us trample upon more elevated principles and ignore what we most fervently revere. Our deepest wish would be that someone could come along and save us from ourselves. An occasional paternalistic reminder to behave well does not have to constitute an infringement upon our liberty, as this term has been properly understood. Real freedom does not mean being left wholly to one's own devices. It should be compatible with being harnessed and guided. Modern marriages are a test case of the problems created by an absence of a moral atmosphere. We start off with the best of intentions, with a maximal degree of communal support. All eyes are upon us, family, friends, employees of the state. They all appear to be invested in mutual happiness, good behavior. This is assuming you have a secular wedding. But soon enough, we find ourselves alone with our wedding gifts and our conflicted natures. And because we are weak-willed creatures, the compact we are so lately engaged in begins to erode. Heady romantic longings are fragile materials with which to construct a relationship. We grow thoughtless and mendacious towards each other. We surprise ourselves with how rude we become. We become deceitful and vindictive. We may try to persuade the friends who visit us on the weekend to stay a little longer because their regard and their affection remind us of the high expectations we once had for ourselves. But in our souls, we know we are suffering because there is no one there to nudge us to reform our ways and to make an effort. Religions get this. They know that to sustain goodness, it helps to have an audience. The faiths, then, provide us with a gallery of witnesses at the ceremonial beginnings of our marriages, literally and figuratively, and thereafter they entrust a vigilant role to their God. However sinister the idea of such surveillance might seem at first, it can in truth be reassuring to live as though someone else were continually watching and hoping for the best from us. It is gratifying to feel that our conduct is not simply our own business. It makes the momentous effort of acting nicely seem easier when we know we're being watched. Isn't that true? I mean, truly, indeed. And of course, in Orthodoxy and Christianity, the one who's watching is benevolent and good and merciful and kind and supporting us, is what we believe. It's also true, my dad owns a small business in Jacksonville, and he had these surveillance guys come trying to sell video monitoring equipment. He has like 30 or 40 employees, and they said, you know, you need to get this equipment. And my dad was expecting the argument of, well, watch them, and you can punish them when they, you know, waste time, etc. And they said, no, it's not that at all. They said, if you install this stuff, your productivity, if you never look at anything, the productivity goes up because they think you're watching them. And so they know, if I do a good job, the boss is watching me. And so the productivity goes. My dad didn't, I think he probably should have. He didn't buy the equipment. But he was really impressed. And several of his friends who bought the stuff said it really, really worked. And it also gave the boss a chance, if he did look at it, to see who was working well. And what was more impacting was not punishing those who were lazy, but rather rewarding those who were doing well. You know, so surveillance has its pluses. And I think he's making a very good point there. One of the challenges to people's general health, the De Botton argues, is that disbelief in God has led to lack of confidence in notions of good and bad. And of course, a notion of good and bad provides probably one of the only sane frameworks for having a meaningful life. So someone can say seductively, God is dead. But then what? You know, that's the problem he's identifying. And so here's a paragraph about this. Much of the modern moral thought has been transfixed by the idea that a collapse in belief must have irreparably damaged our capacity to build an ethical framework for ourselves. But this argument, while apparently atheistic in nature, owes a strange, unwarranted debt to religion. For only if we truly believed at some level that God at once existed, had at once existed, and that the foundations of morality were therefore in their essence supernatural, would the recognition of this of the present non-existence of God have any power to shake our moral principles. So even here, he's saying, the very problems that we're speaking about are dancing around the question of God. So much of what is healthy in authentic religion is at the very least the product of society seriously reflecting upon what promotes goodness among its people, on one hand, and on the other hand, what bad practices cause disorder and hatred and fragmentation in a society and in a family. And these things, you know, we believe, of course, they come from God, but whether you believe it or not, there's value, he's saying, in what they have to say. You know, and I don't think there's any kind of problem in admitting that, do you? I mean, that doesn't trouble me in the slightest. As a Christian, I think about the ideas of natural law. And I'm no philosopher, Trevor, but when I look at these sort of things, what I take from it is that, well, there's a profound need for God, and the whole human psychological experience is constructed around this space that we would identify as God, you know, in the mental landscape of our souls and our society. And so, but people are going to take what they want to when they see these things, of course. He spends a good portion of time, and I want to review a little bit of it, on the idea, let me see here, the idea of original sin. Original sin, what is it? This phrase tends to be used by Roman Catholics. We Orthodox tend to speak of ancestral sin or ancestral curse. As we understand this idea of ancestral sin, we would see it as a tendency or a penchant for sin that is passed down rather than inherited guilt per se. So in other words, when we speak about original sin or ancestral sin, what we're saying is that we don't believe that when Adam sinned necessarily, we're all guilty for what Adam did. What we believe is that in the human condition, which Adam is the first, we are inclined to sin from birth. Our nature has been undermined by sin, and therefore we have a penchant for sin, an orientation towards sin that is not really God's will, but he permits. That's in a nutshell. What de Botton says, I don't think depends upon a very precise definition of original sin, but he finds this idea to be very important. Among religion's more unpalatable features is the tendency of their clergies to speak to people as if they, and they alone, were in possession of maturity and moral authority. Okay? Yet Christianity never sounds more beguiling than when it denies this child-adult dichotomy and acknowledges that we are all, in the end, rather infantile, incomplete, unfinished, easily tempted, and sinful. Think of the evening prayer as you read, right? We say these sorts of things. We talk about our weaknesses, our sins. We can read that as condemnation, but I actually would like to read it the way he reads it, which I think is very liberating. We are readier to absorb lessons about virtues and vices if they are delivered by characters who are already fully acquainted with both categories. Hence the ongoing charm and utility of original sin. The Judeo-Christian tradition has intermittently appreciated that we can that what can stop us from reforming ourselves is a lonely, guilty sense of how especially bad and beyond saving we already are. These religions have therefore proclaimed, with considerable sang-froid, that all of us, without exception, are appallingly flawed creatures. Quote, "Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and sins of my mother conceived me," thunders the Old Testament, Psalm 51. A message echoed anew by St. Paul. As by one man sin entered the world, and by death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for all have sinned, Romans 5. However, the recognition of this darkness is not the end point in these faiths, which modern pessimism assumes it must be. That we are tempted to deceive, steal, insult, egotistically ignore other people, and be unfaithful is accepted without surprise. And this is really important. The question is not whether we experience shocking temptations, but whether we are able once in a while to rise above them. The doctrine of original sin encourages us to inch towards moral improvement. We would say inch toward it with God's help, right? By understanding that the faults we despise in ourselves are the features that everyone in our species faces. We can therefore admit to them candidly. We can admit to these sins candidly and attempt to rectify them in the light of day. The doctrine of original sin understands that shame is not a helpful emotion for us to be weighed down with as we work towards having a little less to be ashamed about. Enlightenment thinkers believe that they were doing us a favor by declaring man to be originally good. You know, the whole Rousseau, you know, noble savage idea. However, being repeatedly informed of our native decency can cause us to become paralyzed with remorse over our failures to measure up to impossible standards of perfection. Confessions of universal sinfulness turn out to be a better starting point in which to take our first steps toward virtue. An emphasis then on original sin further serves to answer any doubts as to who can have the right to dispense moral advice in our democratic age. To the incensed query, "And who are you to tell me how to live?" a believer need only push back and say, the disarming response, "I'm a fellow sinner." We are all descended from a single ancestor, the fallen Adam, and are therefore beset by identical anxieties, temptations toward iniquity, cravings for love, and occasional aspirations to purity. Isn't that neat? I don't know. I found that very encouraging. This is someone who gets our tradition, I think. He gets the orientation of our church. And he's probably reading our tradition through the Roman Catholic lens. But this is very important. And I would submit to you that it's vital that we get that part of our tradition. If we don't get it, we mess up our own faith, right? Because then we can become self-haters. We become men and women who can't believe that God can actually help change us. You know, he might not see God here, but this is all about God for us, right? This is what Christ comes to address. And he comes while we're yet sinners. And so we have confidence then that he's not finished with us yet. You know, and when I give you a sermon, I don't give you a sermon as one who has all the answers. The only authority by which I can claim to serve you is the grace of Christ in me, working in me a sinner. You know? And that's the very basis for all that we do in our church. And it's possible to hang out with the Orthodox or with other Christians and not get that for years. I won't give any examples because that would be a violation of pastoral, but I see it from time to time, people that don't understand that. It's very destructive. So thank you, Alain de Botton. He kind of gets it in his own weird way. Do you have any questions about that? That's my favorite little part here tonight before we end. Any questions for me or thoughts there? Okay. Let's turn then. Fostering virtues and recognizing vices. What he speaks about in the next part of the chapter is that any authentic religious tradition is going to take very seriously the idea of inculcating a clear vision of what is good and what is bad, right? Because that's part of having a system that actually helps people to live their lives, right? And he goes into a Renaissance chapel in Florence. I believe it's one of Giotto's chapels. And it depicts beautifully the virtues and vices that believers are to contemplate. And so he writes the following about this experience. In this chapel, the artist Giotto decorated the walls with a series of frescoes. There are 14 niches, each one containing a portrait allegorizing a different vice or virtue. On the right-hand side of the church nearest the nave, Giotto painted the so-called cardinal virtues, prudence, fortitude, temperance, and justice, followed by the Christian virtues of faith, charity, and hope. Directly opposite, these were arrayed in matching configuration of vices, folly, inconstancy, anger, injustice, infidelity, envy, and despair. To each of these abstract titles, the painter appended vivid specimens to evoke viewers' admiration or stir their guilt. Thus anger is shown tearing apart her garments, screaming at the sky in self-pity, while 2 inches of long infidelity squints out with deceitful eyes. Members of the congregation were to sit in their pews and think about the virtues, which ones they had embraced, and which vices they had fallen prey to, while God watched over them from up on high with the stars in hand. So the point of this chapel was we would be oriented morally and ethically about the arrangement of their lives, to see embodiments of these virtues and vices. By contrast to this Christian desire to generate a moral atmosphere, libertarian theorists have argued that public space should be kept neutral. There should be no reminders of kindness on the walls of our buildings or in the pages of our books. Such messages would, after all, constitute dramatic infringements upon our much-prized liberty. However, we have already seen why this concern for liberty doesn't necessarily honor our deepest wishes, given our compulsive and wayward natures. We can also now admit that, in any case, our public spaces are not even remotely neutral. They are, as a quick glance in any street will reveal, covered with commercial messages. Even in societies theoretically dedicated to leaving us free to make our own choices, our minds are continually manipulated in directions we hardly recognize consciously. It is sometimes said by an advertising agency, in a prophylactic attempt at false modesty, that advertising really does not work well. We are adults, as argument holds, and do not lose our capacity to reason. The answer we set eyes upon a beautifully photographed billboard or catalog. It is granted that our children may be less resolute and could therefore need shielding from certain messages on television before 8 o'clock in the evening, lest they conceive a maniacal craving for a particular train set or a carbonated beverage. But adults are apparently sensible. We are self-controlled enough not to alter our values or consumption patterns simply on account of an unceasingly array of artfully created images and messages which reach out to us from every side at all times of the day and the night. Okay? However, this distinction between child and adult is suspiciously convenient to commercial interests. In truth, we are all fragile in our commitments, and we suffer from weakness of will in relation to the siren call of advertising, an ill-tempered three-year-old entranced by the sight of a farmyard playset with an inflatable dog kennel, as much as a 42-year-old captivated by the possibility of a barbecue set with added tongs and a hot plate. It's true, though, you know, this idea of neutral space is unneutral. And, you know, we can't go back necessarily and, you know, say, you know, let's Christianize the public space. But on the same, by the same token, let's not kid ourselves and pretend that public spaces at this time, in this day and age, are neutral, because they're not. And how we fill our spaces at home, I would argue, are ways that we reinforce, either reinforce the commercialization of space that we get outside, or reinforce the values we wish to reinforce in our lives as Christians, right? You know, what does our home look like? What are the spaces that we live and move in? You know, and in what ways can we as Christians impact public spaces? Hopefully in ways that don't infringe upon the people, perhaps, but ways that make those spaces better for us. I think these are questions we can certainly address. But I would say, you know, I like it. I'm actually, this is totally parenthetical. This is my personal view. I like it when I drive down the street and see different religious expressions outside. I like it when I see the menorah at Hanukkah and when I see the Christmas nativity set. It's not so much about saying this is dogmatically something or another. It's about saying that these are what people are doing. This is part of their life. This is what's going on in their lives, their homes. And it's making its way into the public sphere. And I think that's fascinating. I think that's beautiful. And it gets us outside of just the commercialization of the public space and allows us to see into what people are doing in their homes, in their lives. So he has this little photo here of, you know, instead of a coffee billboard, a forgiveness billboard. It's a little idea. what would it look like? You know, we don't only need reminders of the advantages of savory snacks. What about forgiveness? You know, he's got some funny photos. I'll show some of them are a little off color. I can show you later. So role models, aka saints. While paying attention to the messages in its public spaces, Christianity also wisely recognizes the extent to which our concepts of good and bad are shaped by the people we spend time with. It knows that we're dangerously permeable with regard to our social circle, all too apt to internalize and mimic others' attitudes and behaviors. Simultaneously, it accepts that the particular company we keep is largely the result of haphazard forces, a peculiar cast of characters drawn from our childhood, from schooling, from our community, and from work. Among the few hundred people we recognize regularly, not very many are likely to be sorts of exceptional individuals who exhaust our imagination with their great qualities, who strengthen our soul, and whose voices we want to consciously adopt to bolster our best impulses. Think about your workplaces, right? You know, how many of those people do you want, you know, as your voice of conscience and your voice of reason? I guess I'm lucky because I have people that around me that are at least striving toward the right things. You know, everyone in this room is striving toward the right things in some form or fashion, but you go places and people that don't even strive. Not to judge them, but, you know, what do you do? He continues, the paucity of paragons helps to explain why Catholicism, for example, sets before its believers some 2,000 plus of the greatest, most virtuous human beings who, it feels, have ever lived. These saints are each in their own different ways exemplars of qualities we should hope to nurture in our own lives. Saint Joseph, for instance, may teach us how to cope calmly with the pressures of a young family and how to face the trials of the workplace with a modest and uncomplaining temper. There are moments when we may want to break down and sob in the company of Saint Jude, that patron of lost causes, whose gentle manner can grant us comfort without any need to find immediate solutions or even hope. I'm sorry. At times of anxiety, we can turn to St. Philip Neri, who would never underplay our problems or humiliate us, but would know how to tease out our sense of the absurd and make us laugh therapeutically at our condition. We might find it particularly consoling to guess how the imperturbable St. Philip would handle the hazards of a family reunion or the crash of the computer's hard drive. To further enhance our imaginative connections with the saints, the Catholic Church provides us with calendars that list their death days, that we might have a regular occasion to withdraw from our social circle and contemplate the lives of people who gave away all their money or wandered the earth or did good works while wearing a rough tunic to mortify their flesh, St. Francis, or who used their faith in God to magically reattach a severed ear to its distressed owner's head, St. Cuthbert. You know, and he goes on. But, you know, what's funny about church life is you have these saints, and you have patrons of different things. You know, you have St. Pantaleon, and the holy mercenaries are the healers. You know, St. Ksenia is the one you pray to when you're looking for a job. St. Trifon is another one you pray for with a job. The Theotokos, when we're looking for consolation. But we also, in Orthodoxy, have a very strong monastic movement still. And one of the things I remember reading early on in my journey into Orthodoxy was about the role of the monastics is to be a prophetic voice for godliness. They don't always live up to that, but that's what they're called to do. They're called to be a prophetic voice to us, an image of something that we're to strive for and with. And in general, I'll tell you, the monks I've known, most of them are very good, and the nuns that hold their mission the same way, they provide this like example. You know, and of course, if we got to know them and their foibles, you'd see all kinds of things that would cause you to, you know, so-and-so has a bad temper or whatever. That's not the point. But they're offering a lot. They're doing these things for the sake of something good and beautiful. And that can and should, I think, inspire us, even as we don't idolize them. So, he also speaks about the, I think rather humorously, of the role of images in the Catholic Church. When I was in Catholic school, I had a teacher who liked to collect little plastic figurines of Jesus. And she also had a little figurine of Mr. Spock and Luke Skywalker, which is kind of funny. But he kind of gets the humor of some of this, I think. Catholicism perceives that there is a benefit to being able to see our ideal friends around the house in miniaturized form. After all, most of us began our lives having nurturing relationships with bears and other animals to whom we could talk and be tacitly addressed by in turn. Though immobile, these animals were nevertheless skillful at conveying their consoling and inspiring personalities to us. We would talk to them. We were sad and were comforted when we looked across the bedroom and saw them stoically enduring the night on our behalf. Catholicism sees no reason to abandon the practice in adulthood, and so invites us to buy wood, stone, resin, or plastic versions of the saints and place them on shelves or alcoves in our rooms and hallways. At times of domestic chaos, we can look across at the plastic statuette and say, and ask what St. Francis would recommend that we say to our furious wife and hysterical children. The answer would be inside of us, but it doesn't usually emerge or become effective until we go through the exercise of asking the question of a saintly figurine. You know, and you can take this with a grain of salt. It's fun. He's having a good time here. But there's something about externalizing what we're going through that, again, authentic religion gets. And, of course, if it stops there, then it's not that meaningful. But, you know, he's picking up on all the things that we have in our church life that call us to sanity, that call us to give us support, that help us do the things that God is, in our view, is calling us to do and be. And so, in conclusion, I want to read this last short paragraph. The religious perspective on morality suggests that it is, in the end, a sign of immaturity to object too strenuously to being treated like a child. The libertarian obsession with freedom ignores how much of our original childhood need for constant constraint and guidance endures within us, and therefore how much we stand to learn from paternalistic strategies. It is not very kind, nor ultimately very freeing, to be deemed so grown up that one is left alone to do entirely as one pleases. Isn't that true? So that's kind of, you know, I read this and I think, wow, this is exactly why, being a Christian, I was drawn to Orthodox faith, right? Because I wanted something beyond just a dogmatic belief in God. That wasn't enough. Because Orthodox Christianity originally, I mean, early church, it wasn't just what to believe, it was how to live. In fact, until the second or third century, the Our Father prayer wasn't even taught until after you're baptized. You would learn how to be a Christian. You would learn some of the basic mystery of who Christ was, what his role was, what baptism meant. You would learn a little bit of these things. And you were drawn by the way Christians lived their life, though. You saw their courage in the face of defeat. You saw their love for their neighbors. You saw the goodness that they had in their lives. And you wanted to be joined to that. And so they would begin to teach you about their God, about their faith. But they taught you the way they lived. And they invited you into that. And then later, after you're baptized, they would teach you the Our Father and all the mysteries of the faith, what baptism fully meant, what the Eucharist meant. It was common, actually, that you would never see the Eucharist performed until after you were baptized. You wouldn't even be present in the room. The phrase, the doors, and wisdom let us attend, that was close the doors. Well, the catechumen was already kicked out, right? Catechumen is depart, let no one remain, right? They get kicked out, and then we bar the doors right before communion, before the anaphora prayers. And there's something beautiful about that. But the idea that he speaks of about becoming like a child is important too. And Jesus speaks about this. Jesus says, "Amen, I say to you, unless you convert and become like children, you will in no wise enter the kingdom of heaven." So let us become like children. You know, let us recognize that we need the star chart. You know, we need the cliches we might get in confession, right? We need, you know, the real basic food of the scriptures. You know, sometimes we can read a passage and it's very basic, and then we can go and study it. And sometimes we just need the very simple teaching, just to read it, not even study it, just be exposed to it and have the heart of a child. So, anyway, God bless you all. Next week we have our last. We have two more classes before Thanksgiving. One of my favorite chapters in the whole book is formation. What is the purpose of education? This will challenge, I think, just to give you a preview, you know, nowadays we go to school to get information. The medieval mind, the pre-modern mind, Christian mind especially, got the education was about building up our lives and our character, our very persons. So we'll contrast these two approaches. And he totally gets this, and it's really interesting how he makes a case for this when you don't believe in God. But it's really fascinating. So you guys have a great night. God bless you. Let's sing It Is Truly Me.